I get it. People get squeamish. They don't like an algorithm deciding what's going to happen with their life.
Your argument is basically the humans are the racist ones and the algorithms actually weighing the bigger, more relevant variables.
We allow humans to override. We're going to release more dangerous people. There will be more violent crimes.
I suppose I still see value in nuance, right? In being able to take a suggestion that an algorithm provides and then appropriately contextualize it with things that maybe the human is more adept at perceiving.
As you develop technology that is more and more powerful and it's wielded by fewer and fewer people, like the results seem to be reliably negative.
The world is full of robophobia. And we judge algorithms and robots much more harshly than we do humans.
Welcome back to Radius of Reason, a podcast where we discuss the greatest problems facing humanity. My name is Andre, and I am joined by my co-host, Levon.
Today's guest is Ryan Kopus. He's a professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, who focuses on the application of AI algorithms on the justice system.
We talked about if these algorithms are less racist than humans, and if in fact these algorithms should be used to replace human decision making.
In a lot of contexts, especially those 0-1 contexts, where you're just trying, where the decision matters, right? You're just focused on, is this person going to commit a crime? A crime that we care about, maybe not a drug crime, but some violent crime, that algorithms outperform humans. And as time has gone on, we've gotten better data and better algorithms. That gap between humans and algorithms has grown. A co-author and I, last year published a paper analyzing New York's parole board. And we got some data, and we built an algorithm on that data. And then showed that if you used that algorithm, to make decisions, right? Basically you generate predictions for how likely this person is to commit a violent crime, or a different type of crime, whatever you want to predict. And if you use the algorithm and only release the people with low predicted probabilities, right, that you could either release the same number of people as the parole board has been releasing while reducing the arrest rate in half, or you could keep the same arrest rate and release twice as many people. And these are under pretty conservative assumptions. So that is just that's just a $100 bill sitting there on the street. Like, keeping people in prison is awful for them. It's awful for society. It's expensive. We want more people out of prison if they're not high risk. And so algorithms are just exceptionally good at identifying who's low risk and who we can get out of prison.
So there's been a lot of investigative work done around this, and ProPublica has been absolutely frothing at the mouth due to some pretty well documented instances of bias coming to play with these algorithms.
Yeah. Can I push back right away?
Absolutely. Do your thing.
I do not like that article.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying this episode, just a quick reminder to like and subscribe.
We always love hearing from you, so leave us a comment. Let us know what you're thinking.
It is one of my least favorite articles. I remember when it came out, I think it was around 2014, 15, 16. I was in
2016.
I was in grad school, and there was a lot of exciting work around these types of algorithms. Good faith academics really trying to build and think hard about these algorithms and how to make the world better, how to get more people out of prison, to be honest. This is all at Berkeley, right? So most Berkeley people want to get people out of prison. And so we're working on these algorithms, and then that article comes out, and now, man, everybody hates these algorithms. Just emotionally, I'm a little pissed at ProPublica for sort of disrupting that nice, good faith environment where people didn't look at us researchers as evil monsters. But after that article, it was a lot harder to talk about using those algorithms. And particularly why I'm upset about that article is that article says that it finds racial bias.
Right.
But they come up with a definition of racial bias that's never been used in law before. It's totally new. They do no work to justify why what they found.
What was their definition?
Their definition was they focused on false positive rates and false negative rates. So of black people where the algorithm says you are going to commit a crime, right? What percentage don't commit a crime? And there, right, as an example. And those false positive, false negative rates were different as between black and white people.
But they had a few pretty well-documented cases where kind of this risk scoring system that this algorithm produced to support, I think, parole hearings. They had quite a number of documented cases where a white, prisoner, I don't know what the appropriate term in this situation would be, receives a low score and then goes on to commit a series of crimes resulting in them going back to jail.
Yes.
Where by default, somebody being black, and again, this is to the point about the bias that's present in in the algorithm or the, I guess, to create a fair conversation, I'll say the alleged bias, would rank or score somebody a higher risk, provide somebody with a higher risk score based on the fact of where they were coming from and inevitably speaking the color of their skin.
So that's not true.
Okay.
First, you're right. They do have some of those narratives, but those are just anecdotes. They just found a white person that said, hey, this person was supposed to be low risk. And then they went out and committed a crime. Then they find a black person and like, hey, this person was supposed to be high risk, but come on. She's not high risk. And yeah, you're going to be able to find situations like that ex post after the fact. No one's claiming algorithms get things 100% right. But knowing what I know about predicting arrest, I don't blame the algorithm for making the guess it did. It did not consider race. It did not consider the location, like zip code or anything of that sort. What it considered was age. The black person in that particular example that they highlighted was young and had committed a crime at a young age. The other dude was approaching his 40s. The single biggest predictor of whether or not you're going to commit a crime in the future is your age. Young people are dumb. Right. And then they grow out of it. And 40-year-olds just don't often commit crimes. So I wasn't at all surprised to see that the algorithm recommended release for the 40-year-old.
But then I suppose that's also a little bit bleak where, fine, you commit a crime when you're young. You do your time in jail and you're up for a parole hearing. And then a computer program assigns you an arbitrary score because, oh, yeah, you're young. You're going to likely commit a crime again. So, no, you're not going to get early release. That doesn't seem like a rational execution of justice at that point.
Well, I guess it depends what your vision of justice is. I am a self-identified consequentialist. I want the world to be as good as it can be. And meaning to say that talks of rights and fairness don't do much for me. Like, I think talks of rights and fairness, rights can be good to have in the world because they make the world a better place through consequences. But too often people want to bring up rights as a way to say, no, although option X would make the world a better place, mm-hmm. you can't pursue that option because of rights.
Well, and certain rights are also enshrined in a legal statute, right? Certain rights are guaranteed to you as prescribed by citizenship, as prescribed by constitution. Like, rights aren't just a ethereal kind of hokey element. They are things that are guaranteed to us by, I guess, documented status.
Yes. And that's good. We should have lots of rights in the world.
I'm glad we can agree on that. Yeah.
For practical purposes.
Yes.
And I think too often people lean back and almost start thinking about those hokey ethereal rights, that there's somehow rights exist. I don't know how. I've never understood the deontologist.
Hey, everyone. Hope you're enjoying the episode. If you want to support this channel, please be sure to like and subscribe.
And of course, let us know what you think. Drop a comment.
But I mean, to get back to this particular point, like, if, yes, I get it. People get squeamish. They don't like an algorithm deciding what's going to happen with their life. We could talk about why that is, but I'll just take for granted right now that people don't seem to like it.
But your argument is basically the reverse, that the humans are the racist ones and the algorithms actually weighing the bigger, more relevant variables like age, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're saying. It's focused. It's sorting based on like the proper weights of the variables as opposed to humans, which would focus more on race and other things that are not as relevant as they might appear.
Yeah. So there are a few things there, right? A, I'll just give you credit, a lot of credit right off the bat for when you're discussing algorithmic bias, actually mentioning human bias.
Right. Yeah.
So many articles out there just critique algorithms for being biased without any mention of the alternative.
And I think ProPublica does call that out as well, where they do mention that the bias is present inherently speaking because they're a reflection off a human system.
ProPublica does not know why they think it's biased. I think that's a bit of a mess. They came up with some weird statistical test that nobody had ever used, that lawyers had never used to define bias, and just ran with it. They could have gone more traditional route to say, look, oh, it's biased because historical arrest data is biased. Right, that black people are arrested more often relative to how much crime they commit than white people are. That's promising. We could talk about the extent to which that's true, right, and ways around it. But they didn't go that route. They went this other route where even though race was not used in the algorithm, even though that zip code was not used in the algorithm, that basically what they're reporting. In any system where one group of people has a much higher rate of committing crimes and another group of people have a much lower rate of committing crimes, well, an algorithm is going to, this group of people is going to tend to be defined as having higher predicted probabilities of committing crimes. And that's in Broward County where this is studied, right? That was those were the facts on the ground. And so any algorithm, perfectly accurate algorithm, not like 100%, 0% perfect, but, you know, but an algorithm that says, hey, this group of people, they have a 90% chance of committing a violent crime. And then you look and yeah, 90% of those people go on to commit a crime. That's what I mean by accurate, well-calibrated. A well-calibrated algorithm is going to yield those false positive, false negative disparities that ProPublica focused on.
I was just going to say real quick, just to be clear, I think even if an algorithm is showing that it is predicting accurately that, you know, this one group is going to commit more than the other, that doesn't necessarily mean that group is inherently more criminal in, you know, in nature. It means, well, but I think sometimes people conflate that when they hear that, like, oh, what are you suggesting, that they're just bound to be criminals? And I think that distinction just, yeah, it needs to be very clearly made.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's sort of the other issue that this kind of risk scoring system presents, is that it doesn't take into account some of like the outlying factors like, class or socioeconomic mobility, some of the depth to each unique circumstance where somebody might commit a crime, right? I guess, ultimately speaking, the question I have is, with this kind of risk scoring thing, there are other factors coming into play as well, right? It's not as if a parole judge just sees like, oh, this guy's like a 7, let's release him. It's supposed to enrich that workflow. Am I correct?
Well, it depends who you talk to. Right. Why parole is such an easy stage of the criminal justice system to study is really it only has one goal. Let out low risk people. It's not about punishment anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. The sentencing was about that. So you've been punished and now we're just holding on to you because we think you might be dangerous. And so we're trying to find the people who aren't dangerous and let them out. And so there's just this one goal, this one thing we care about, dangerousness. And algorithms are just exceptionally good, at least as compared to humans, at identifying that dangerousness. Now, in my world, humans would defer to those algorithms. Just we could basically get rid of the humans. We're not ready to do that as a society. So we do have a judge who mixes in their own judgment with that algorithmic recommendation and makes worse decisions, right? You add that human judgment to the algorithm. Now you sacrificed a lot of the gains because that human's going to override the algorithm and they're going to make more mistakes.
I guess someone referred to it as maybe course correcting the algorithm, or maybe applying a little bit more of like a rational lens to just the suggestions that an algorithm makes.
What do you
It's a
mean?
less rational lens, right? Is what you're arguing, Ryan. It's, and any amount of additional input from the human is a net negative on the aggregate like decision making capacity.
I suppose I still see value in nuance, right? And being able to take a suggestion that an algorithm provides and then appropriately contextualize it with things that maybe the human is more adept at perceiving.
It depends. So there is value, but the value is not in accuracy. It will not lead to better decisions in terms of we're going to release more safer people. No, if we do this, if we allow humans to override, we're going to release more dangerous people. There will be more violent crimes out there in the world. So there's no value there, right? The research is pretty clear. You let humans override these algorithms and you're going to cause a lot more crime out there in the world.
Has this been replicated? Like this research, like, I mean, how confident are we that this would be the case if it was adopted like en masse?
It's been replicated a number of times. We are pretty confident that, I mean, a lot of research also showing that you allow humans the ability to override, you start decreasing accuracy. But we do have these algorithms in practice. We're using them, not terribly sophisticated ones. But the problem is judges just override them all the time. So we're not really getting the value. But I will say there is value, a different type of value, right? There's value in what people call procedural justice. People like it when you get to tell your story and the human gets to respond to your nuance. You feel more well-treated and a better part of your community, right? And that's real value. But the trade-off is you're going to have more crime or you're going to have to keep more people in prison.
What's, I mean, maybe to elaborate on Levon, what you asked, how proliferated are these algorithms right now? Is it at like a jurisdictional basis, depending on like what county or community the parole hearing is happening in? Is it a standard now where every parole board might be equipped with this sort of like algorithmic support?
I think it's becoming increasingly standard. I don't know about all parole boards, but for example, New York Parole Board, they use the Compass algorithm, the same one that was critiqued in the ProPublica
Right,
study. That one is sort of just a big general purpose one. It's not really tailored to a specific jurisdiction. Others, some universities have collaborated with local governments to build more sophisticated algorithms. Arnold Ventures, the philanthropic group, has put out a publicly available risk algorithm. And I don't know how many people are using that because you don't have to pay for it. You can just, if you're a parole board, you can go and
Shouldn't they all be like public? Shouldn't that be like a, I mean, I guess maybe this is a good time to transition to like what could go wrong? Because even if we grant that, you know, in kind of this narrow domain that the algorithms are producing more accurate kind of outcomes or better outcomes, if we zoom out and look at the broader context, you know, like one of my main concerns is if you really adopt this sort of thinking and you're letting algorithms dictate more and more things, you're creating a kind of more centralized mechanism for decision making, which very few people understand. And so you're creating more fragility in the system and less trust. How could you possibly like overcome that given, you know, human nature and human just, I mean, you know, talk about the tribalism between people. I mean, imagine like, you know, the tribalism between humans and algorithms, right?
Yeah. So I do think the proprietary nature of some of these algorithms is a reason for concern. Not in love with that, right? It is weird to be sentenced by an algorithm that you can't inspect, that you can't hire at least a team of experts to say, mm-hmm. wait, is this really doing what it says mm-hmm. it's doing?
Can we red do flag number one.
right. Yeah. And so far they've gotten away with it.
But by they, do you mean like when you say proprietary, is it like private sector kind of?
Yeah. Private company.
Gotcha.
Developed a Compass algorithm. You know, the trade-off is, and maybe it's not that much of a trade-off, but proprietary companies have an incentive to try to build really good algorithms. And by giving them these proprietary rights, you might get better algorithms built on better data that costs a lot of money to try to gather together. How that trade-off ultimately works, I don't know. I don't know the right balance between. You could at least imagine, all right, maybe it doesn't have to be publicly available, but someone being subject to a Compass decision is allowed to hire some people to inspect the algorithm, right? Sort of confidentially and with a promise not to release the details.
That's just a government regulation where they have inspectors that look at the code and the algorithms to make sure there's nothing funky.
Which we don't have those regulations right now, I believe. And that's kind of the bleak prospect of the regulatory environment for tech in general.
Yep. Okay. What about on the fragility of the system, you know, as you relinquish more and more decision-making to these algorithms, you know, you kind of, humans lose their sharpness and their, I mean, maybe even understanding of the law and like all sorts of things, you know, that come downstream of that.
Yeah. So that is a real thing. I think people call it skill drift. Mm. Right. As you use algorithms and then the algorithm might break, society changes and that algorithm, right. Doesn't work anymore. And all of a sudden you're like, oh God, we still have to keep on making these decisions. So I think there are different strategies. And I don't know if this is diving into the weeds a little too much, but one of the real problems with algorithms is that, I mean, it's a benefit, but it's a problem. The benefit of an algorithm is it's not noisy. It always makes the same decision, right? You give it the person with these factors and we'll say, all right, parole, or say no parole. Humans are noisy. Like I might make, given the same factors, might say parole. And then 2 days later, given those same factors, might say don't parole. Or even if it's not sort of internal noise, if the case gets assigned to me, I might make a very different decision if it gets assigned to my colleague judge, right? So human decision-making systems have tons of noise in them, which is a source of error and causes lots of problems. Lots of dangerous people get put on the streets and lots of safe people get stuck in prison. Algorithms are not noisy. That can cause a problem for algorithms down the road because imagine, right? Algorithms need to update over time. because they grow stale. Society changes, right? The meaning of inputs changes in all sorts of ways. So you need to update them. But the data that an algorithm produces isn't good data for updating, because it's only released the people it thought was safe. It never gets to see, wait a second, these people that I didn't release, would they have committed crime? Maybe over time, things change such that these people have actually become safe people, right? And you don't get to see that. When you're having humans override, you at least humans will mess up and let those people out sometimes so you can keep learning, right? Keep staying updated. So I think one promising sort of, or one idea that we're pushing is, let's not start thinking about just all humans versus all algorithms. Let's sort of combine them in a way where we'll let humans override these denials, right? Not because we think they're going to make short-term, more accurate decisions, but because we actually need to see some of these people. We need some mistakes from the humans so that the algorithm can continue to learn from those mistakes.
So it kind of sounds like an experiment to a certain extent. Like, you just need more data.
Yeah.
And
humans will give it to us in a way that society will accept. I do not think society will accept, hey, we need this algorithm to just randomly release high-risk people every once in a while. But they'll accept a judge overriding it, even though it's just going to give us some dangerous people out there in the world.
Is that acceptance, do you think, a question of just getting comfortable around the technology, or is it something innate to humans that we're not going to trust machines with these sorts of decisions? I mean, is it kind of like how 100 years ago somebody would be exceptionally uncomfortable in flying in an airplane, whereas now it's a far more acceptable mode of transportation, very ubiquitous? Like, is this something that will evolve to the point where we will be completely okay with this sort of scenario that you described, where an algorithm just spits out a decision and we run with it?
I have no idea.
No window on the human condition.
I know now that the world is full of what a law professor called robophobia, that we judge algorithms and robots much more harshly than we do humans for their mistakes.
Interesting.
When will we sort of tone down on our robophobia? I don't know. I don't know. We might need like a will and grace for robots.
I mean, I think to a certain extent, I mean, it's justified because, I mean, look at social media algorithms, right? I mean, they're wrecking mental health. They're wrecking social cohesion, I think. Why? I mean, it is just from that standpoint, like, why should we cede more control to algorithms? Because it's not just the algorithm itself. Like, the algorithm is a neutral thing. It's doing its thing. And it's, from the social media company standpoint, is doing it quite well, mm-hmm. right? But it's always under the umbrella of like human direction and the intended goals of whoever has created the algorithm or whoever has control of it. Yeah. And it's obviously susceptible to corruption, even if you get it right the first time, as you know, it's always going to be under human supervision at some level. Maybe not when there's a super intelligence that emerges, if that is the case. But, you know, until then, like, how do you get over that problem where it's not the problem isn't really the algorithms. It's the fact that you have humans wielding these algorithms. And because of their corrupted nature, you then are, you know, concerned about the algorithm and its output.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say, don't hate the tool, hate the user. These are just tools, and tools can be used in good ways and bad ways. And when tools get used in bad ways, we should be very hesitant to hate the tool, and should focus our ire on the people using the tools in ways that aren't good for the world.
I mean, we don't necessarily have a phobia of like, I mean, I guess you could say there are individuals who have a phobia of firearms, right? But it seems like when it comes to guns, at least a certain percentage of our country does align with the idea that, yeah, it's not the AR-15, it is the individual who is wielding the AR-15. It seems like it's a lot harder to apply that logic to an algorithm, however, where maybe this concept of robophobia is, maybe it's attributed to the uncanny valley, that we can kind of recognize some sort of, I don't want to call it sentience, but it's making a decision, it's conducting a course of action, therefore we see it as a threat, as opposed to just looking at it as a tool. It's,
yeah, I think tool is, I don't think that's a good framing. I think it's, you know, when you talk about some of these algorithms and the fact that you can just scale them indefinitely, they're exponential in nature from that standpoint. And so it's kind of it's a difference of kind as opposed to degrees, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, you seem like you're getting into the like real AI world. Like,
no, even just like social media algorithms, even if you were to, you know, use algorithms to make the parole decisions at a national level, I think you're starting to centralize, you're giving disproportionate power to fewer people, like a smaller number of people, whereas it's decentralized when you have individual judges making those decisions, let's say. So your susceptibility to like...
There's no reason it has to be decentralized. Specific jurisdictions should have algorithms tailored to their specific jurisdiction.
I guess even within a specific jurisdiction, you know, instead of having a number of people making these decisions, you've now limited that basically to an algorithm.
And the group of people responsible for monitoring and updating and checking that algorithm.
I guess over time, I mean, you don't think though, like, I mean, you're not going to have, as the technology becomes more and more sophisticated. I mean, I guess you can make the argument, maybe it gets more democratized as this becomes, you know, just machine learning, maybe open source technology emerges and we
know that open source doesn't really compete well. Like, we have open source like word processors, but I mean, it doesn't like shine a light to the Microsoft Office suite, for instance. And I think, Levon, you do have an interesting point about it is, to a certain extent, I think a fear of surrendering control to a small group of individuals, where there is a feeling that this is masterminded by Silicon Valley, although even I think the company who produced the Compass is somewhere in like Ohio or something like that. But like this notion of like some sort of nebulous oligarchy that's nestled somewhere in Bay Area that's going to be controlling all these things. And as these things become more ubiquitous, they're just going to have a greater and greater chokehold on society.
Chokehold, but also make society a lot better. Like, I mean, I think you just got to take each case on its own and think about whether the benefits are worth the cost. And I think in the case of parole, the benefits are very much worth the cost.
Yeah, I don't know if humans are good at like limiting it to those specific cases, though. I mean, if you implement it for parole decision making, then and it's successful, then like you have all these other domains that are going to be, you know, their appetite's going to be, you know, like raging for that. So, but it may not be as applicable to them, or it may not produce the same kind of positive outcomes. So it's like, I don't think anything's happening in a vacuum. And, you know, if you don't have, you know, if they're already implementing this and there's no regulation from the government, then it's already off to a bad start, in my opinion, even though I don't doubt what you're saying about the research on it producing, you know, superior outcomes. So I think, yeah, my concern is just, okay, it's just another example of we've developed this technology, which is great, but we don't have the wider system in place to properly like get the most out of it and not let it ultimately become a net negative. Because I think certain things have, like social media, the internet, like, great. Like, I'm not convinced social media isn't a net negative at this point. So that's my fears. Like, how do we start off great? Okay, we've got these algorithms that are helping us make better decisions.
And that's not to discount the promise that social media had when I think it really hit the market in force in the early 21st century. I think objectively speaking, initially there was this level of optimism around it where you can connect with friends all over the world. You can meet people. You can share stories about your life. Like, that's all objectively speaking things I think people were quite enchanted by. But to Levon's point, it kind of took on a life of its own, and now it's heading in a direction where I don't think I will agree with him that I don't think it's resulting in a net positive for our society and civilization. And I suspect in the current regulatory environment, algorithms, AI tools, whatever you'll call it, will likely follow a similar course. Like, we have a loose blueprint already laid out for us, where there's promise and there's optimistic use cases potentially, but is it going to stick to that?
Yeah. And I guess I have no damn idea. And I don't think any of us do. And, you know, we got to do something in the world. And in that state of radical uncertainty, I'll push and help make incremental positive changes in the world that we can learn from. And what the butterfly effect is of that.
But I guess, hold on, though. I think the argument that we're trying to make is that there is a precedent for, as you develop technology that is more and more powerful, and it's wielded by fewer and fewer people, like, the results seem to be reliably negative. You know, so it's I don't know if it's as uncertain as you make it out to be. I mean, there is a great deal of uncertainty, but it's just like, there is a precedent, and I think
a precedent.
Say that again.
A precedent, one precedent.
No, I mean, I think the precedent is set by, I mean, there's numerous examples of exponential technology, putting us at greater risk for you know, collapse or other kinds of civilizational instability. I mean, look how fragile our economics. I mean, our economic system is based on. I didn't mean to get into this, but you know, it's just based on infinite growth. It seemed like a harmless idea. It was working well. Growth good. Competition good. Free trade good. And now, okay, what the fuck are, like? How's this going on forever? Like, what are we doing here? Like, there's tremendous instability as a result, and maybe it'll be fine, but doesn't look like it to me from what we know about how the system works, and it's, you know, it's tie it how it's tied into the physical resources, which are limited. But you need more growth, and we'll see where that takes us. But I don't know. I think we should be more cautious. I totally get where you're coming from, though, because you see the value of these algorithms, and it seems like, okay, this is just like, this is a no-brainer. This is the $100 bill, you know, that you spoke of. Like, why not snatch that up? But I don't know. I mean, I do like the fact that you know, you say there should be oversight. There should be some, you know, entanglement with like human error, just to make sure the data sets are not stale over time. So I think that's good. I'm not necessarily against implementing something that is, you know, that we've taken the time to think about the wider systemic context, and all the different unintended consequences, but I don't know. It just seems like we're so, like, humans are like really bad at implementing these technologies. I don't know. I mean, you don't share that view?
I don't think I do. I mean, in some ways I do. We're bad because we have this technology that could be giving us massive benefits. Right? when we do finally get around to implementing the technology, will there be these spillover effects or sort of butterfly effects? I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's almost a guarantee. Action has consequence.
Sure, but I'd be very, very hesitant to pass up a benefit sitting right in front of me that I'm quite confident about to avoid this very fuzzy, very hard to predict sort of side consequences of implementing the tool.
Levon, go ahead.
Like, keep it concrete. You're gonna have a whole bunch of people in prison, and you're gonna have a whole bunch of people getting
No,
assaulted and murdered.
it's fair. I think we can, like, in theory, I think we could get it right. And if, like, the wider system is more conducive toward kind of maximizing, like, the benefits of these technologies, like, I think, you could have something like, what was that movie with Stallone and Wesley Snipes? You guys know what I'm talking about?
It was great. I've seen it many times. You're talking
Fuck.
about,
Oh God, I
oh,
can't. Oh man,
Stallone and Wesley.
I need to remember this.
Demolition
Because
Man.
he
Demolition
wakes
Man.
up from, Demolition Man.
I've never seen Demolition Man.
Oh, it's so good. You got to watch it after this. It's perfect.
It's
But like, I can envision like future scenarios where this is potentially like used well, and it's so much better than things are now as a result. But yeah, I don't know. I take your point. Like, it does seem hard to pass up. You're like, okay, like, we're so bad at these making these decisions. Like, this just seems like a no-brainer. I'm just, yeah, I don't know. I guess I am cautious because of other things I see going on, and maybe this particular thing isn't so bad, but. But the pattern of human behavior that kind of underwrites this thing, it seems like it's something to be wary of. That's, I guess that's all.
What's the debate, Ryan, happening like in academic circles? Like in terms of your immediate peers across other universities, is there like a fairly even split between optimist and pessimist? Is one faction, if you could even call it that, controlling a greater mind share?
Think it very much depends on the discipline. I think economists, by and large, are they're a little late to the game, but and they often are late to games. But once they get there, they win the game. So economists are getting in. And I think they tend to be more pro algorithms because economists are almost all consequentialists. In law schools, I would say it's most people are more critical. Of these algorithms, along a lot of different dimensions, sort of procedural justice dimensions. I don't think they, I think a lot of them still think the ProPublica article showed that algorithms were racist. They don't, and ProPublica does have a follow-up article, by the way, where they basically say, oops. A researcher pointed out that the new definition of fairness that we came up with is totally incompatible and can't have at the same time as this more standard classic definition of fairness. In order to get the thing that we were talking about, you would have to abandon this much more traditional notion and sort of better pedigree of fairness. But there are a number of law professors working in the area that are more favorable as well. They tend to be the ones doing the deeper work on it, the ones getting into the guts and really like building some of their own algorithms.
Let's consider some hypotheticals to mix things up. If we get to a point where these algorithms can predict crime, so you're not talking about parole, you're talking about predicting crime, and you're talking about a Minority Report kind of situation. Should we use them?
I have a very difficult time imagining us getting there. But if you just want to put that aside and let's assume that we can predict.
Not predict. Let's say, let me take that back, because predicting crime is more like fantasy, I think. Predicting like likelihood of crime and someone's, you know, in a, let's say they hit that 99th percentile likelihood of being committing some like egregious crime.
Well, that like, was the controversy around the work Palantir was doing in New Orleans that we kind of started our conversation off, I think, off air, where it's essentially just very robust network analysis they were doing, where it was tying, like pulling together publicly available information on crimes, who performed the crimes, building out like relationship mapping as to like, hey, somebody who is a cousin of this individual who shot up a liquor store, you map that to the relationship, you map that to where that person lives, and then it produces some form of risk analysis. The idea being that the city of New Orleans could then direct that individual into alternate programs, where in theory it was supposed to be this like, okay, you have a certain risk profile because of your affiliation with other criminals. Let's get you into like a community college course or get you into a some sort of therapy program or get you stable housing. Like it had this like veneer of potential altruism, but it very quickly just descended into the police like nabbing people off the streets because of their potential relationship to kind of a criminal nexus. I think that's probably what we are able to do right now. I just don't think there's an appetite for it.
I'll say where Minority Report went wrong and made it a dystopia where it could have been a utopia is they catch these people and then they put them in prison. And it's like, why? Just catch these people and like, take him away for a week and like put him in get some counseling. Like there's no reason that they had to offer this severe punishment. Why do we offer severe punishments? To make sure people don't do things, right? And once you increase the probability of detection really high, you don't have to, you can lower the punishment because you know you're going to get caught. It's when you don't know you're going to get caught that when we do catch you, we have to make sure that we punish you really harshly.
And I think maybe that speaks to some of Devon's concerns, not to put words in your mouth, but if we're deploying some of these models without kind of a commensurate amendment to our, like I'd say our justice system or our way of incarcerating people, or even how our prisons are structured, like maybe that's where the dystopian kind of future starts being paved the way for.
Maybe. I mean, and Levon and I have kind of spoken about this. I think we just have different levels of optimism. Like I can get depressed about democracy and humanity and all the things of that sort. But in the end, I think we're still pretty good at muddling our way through and figuring out how to adapt to things. I just, as a philosophical matter, I don't want to not do the thing that I think by itself is a good idea. Because the broader problems with the ecostructure, I think we got to keep doing the good things and then try to fix the ecostructure. Because if we just wait to do any of the good things until we fix the ecostructure, we're just going to be waiting forever and not get anything done.
It's a fair argument. You know, my concern is the good thing gets abused because it's now a more powerful technology because the ecosystem hasn't been properly updated to handle it. Because if it were, then I would be in lockstep with you on this. Like, of course, like this is a no-brainer. But it's just my confidence in the system is very low. I don't know. I mean, It's a good question, you know, how much effort should be, you know, put towards improving the system versus these kind of more separate components, which are, you know, compromise the wider system. But if I'm being honest, I think there's way more effort right now being put into individual components and not enough to look at things holistically. And that's why we're in this mess. And that doesn't mean what you're saying is wrong. That doesn't mean, you know, your research isn't valuable, but it's just without, I think, that other half of the equation of looking at the wider context and improving that wider system, then, you know, you kind of undermine the benefits that you would get from these new technologies. And that's, I mean, do you have any ideas on how we can, you know, divert more energy resources, like just focus toward making systemic improvements?
Do I know how to achieve better governance? No.
I mean, through like what you know. I mean, you know about the university system, academia. Like from that standpoint, what more could you do or your colleagues do to have an influence, like a positive influence on making some systemic changes?
I mean, I don't imagine much, right? I only teach 100 students a semester. that's a drop in the bucket in the world. Gotta hope all the other professors around the nation are doing their best, but I try to, you know, I've got to teach my students the things I need to teach them, but I go out of my way to teach them epistemic humility and how to think more broadly and rationally about the world as best I can.
I mean, that's a good start, right? Like teaching them to think more broadly. Hopefully all the professors are trying to do that, but it just, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a hard question. And maybe the second half is that's the little tweak. If I had to choose something that I think that could actually be implemented and maybe help the world a lot, is the prediction markets that we're just planning to talk about.
So, if we, maybe you can just speak to that in general. First, what are prediction markets? And secondly, how could we use them to guide policy?
All right. So prediction markets, I think a lot of people probably know about them now. They got their day in the sun with the Trump election. Prediction markets are basically like stock market. Think about it like a stock market for events. So you might have the question, is Trump going to win the presidential election? And it's, you know, 6 months before the election results are going to come in, and you can buy shares of yes or no on Trump. And right, shares, you could say you think there's a 90% probability that Trump's going to win. Well, you can go buy that, because somebody else will sell their share that they bought at 50%, right? And they'll be happy to sell it to you for 90 cents, because they don't think that there's a 90% chance that Trump wins. So if you have that 90 and Trump wins, well, then you get paid out a dollar. You made a profit of 10 cents, right? Right. And you could vote on the no as well, sort of buy those shares. And prediction markets have a lot of different questions where you can go and buy these shares. And the basic intuition behind this is that it will operate much like the stock market does, which is it'll make it such that almost all of us will not be able to beat it. We can't, like, I hope that you guys look at the stock price of McDonald's and say, yeah, I don't know. That's the best I could do. The best I could guess at the value of McDonald's is what the stock price is traded at right now. And why do you do that? Because, you know, there are a lot of really smart people who really want to make a lot of money scouring over McDonald's documents, figuring like Goldman Sachs people, and you don't want to bet against them. They're all betting against each other and they've agreed at this price. And that's kind of where it's stable. You right, would be crazy to think, oh no, I just went to McDonald's last week and it was a mess. McDonald's is way overvalued, right? You do that, you're going to lose a whole bunch of your money. And, right, a lot of people do that, day trading and all these Robinhood apps and things of that sort. And guess what? They generally lose a lot of money. If we had sufficiently robust prediction markets, we would get that same information, right? We'd say, oh, look, shares for Trump winning are trading at 60%. What do I think Trump's probability of winning is? For most of us, we just look at the prediction market and say about 60%. If you really think otherwise, then you can go buy shares and try to make a lot of money, but you're probably not going to. So I think that's sort of just what prediction markets are, what function they could serve if we had really well-functioning ones. We have some decent ones right now, but we could talk about sort of the problems that are holding them back. But if we had really well-functioning, like on the level, functioning on the level of the S&P 500 companies, like that kind of research being done around those questions and depth of the market, I think that could number one, just help fill the gap that has been left by distrust in experts, right? And the distrust in experts that I think a lot of people are talking about right now, or they are my world, I imagine you guys are hearing about it too, right? That a large portion of society is losing trust in experts. We could talk about the reasons that might be true, but I think it's true. And we need a way where we have something we can all point to and have arguments about, rather than you citing this expert and then you citing the counter expert. And nobody actually has any idea how to evaluate these experts. They just kind of believe the expert that they want to believe, right? With a prediction market, you think that, you know, vaccines cause autism at blank rate. Well, maybe there's a prediction market on there, and we can see what it's trading at. And if it's at 1%, right, and you're somebody who says no, it's way more than 1%, it's 100%, then I'm going to point to you and be like, well, then go get rich. Really think.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Like you put $1 in there and you're going to get $100 for every dollar you put in there. So it's kind of a way of if people get used to it, it just grounds us and gets people starting more in terms of probabilities, which they need to be thinking more about as well. And it gives you a nice sort of way of dealing with someone who's wildly overconfident, which is to say, stop talking to me and go be wildly rich. And so that is a basic summary of what I think the core value is. I think there are lots of cool, interesting things you might be able to do with prediction markets as well. Like,
yeah, it seems like a great complement to the current information landscape in terms of being able to resolve some of the just information overload, the conspiracies, and just and now with all the fake AI data that's going to come on board, like it seems like a good way to try to fight back against that. Am I reading what you said correctly on that front?
You are.
My immediate knee-jerk reaction is that it creates like the opportunity for like some weird manipulations of reality where let's like, I don't know, like
where's your blunt?
Right, like, yeah, we're going full Joe Rogan here. Like, yeah, like reality, man. But let's say if somebody, some exceptionally like interesting billionaire decides to throw a whole bunch of money behind one scale of the prediction market on like whatever issue because they really passionately believe in it. And it would maybe artificially inflate one side of like the yes, no divide.
Yeah. And we've seen evidence of that happening with existing markets.
Do you have a specific thing to point to, just as like a frame of reference?
Well, New York Times ran a story. I'm still not sure how much to believe it. We need a prediction market for this.
New York Times.
They ran a story early on in one of the trading markets. Trump was had gone way up over Harris in the presidential election. And New York Times did some investigative work and found that a whole bunch of money was coming from one, obviously very rich, French guy.
Oh, French guy. Nice.
Betting on Trump. And so I still don't know to what extent that amount of money can manipulate the market. They can do that, but they are throwing a whole bunch of money away to do that because an event will happen and then they will lose all that money.
Then it gets into the question of like when you have so much money, like, I mean, trivial, but it does specific to elections. And I think this is where it is a hazard of sorts to maybe the integrity and stability of our institutions, where how often, or I'm not asking you to answer this, it's more of a hypothetical, but somebody's vote is impacted by polling, for instance, right? Where I go and vote for, I don't know, Donald Trump because he is leading in polls and my decision is based on who I think is going to win. Yeah.
Feedback loops.
Yeah. So if you go look at a prediction market and, you know, in the ancient history of French meddling in American politics, dating back to the Marquis de Lafayette, a French billionaire is dumping a whole bunch of money to swing the prediction market in favor of Trump. And then you have a pool of voters that go and decide to vote for Trump because the market is indicating as such. That has some outright manipulative quality to it.
Yeah. That's fair. I think the answer to that is that can be done with today's prediction markets because they're just not that well functioning.
Because they're still immature. But
in a really well functioning prediction market where the Goldman Sachs of the world are in there, I don't care how rich you are as an individual. You're not going to like Goldman Sachs will be like, this dude just bumped the price way up. That's a whole bunch of free money for us. We're going to get it back down. Like, as long as you got enough people playing with enough money, no individual, even small group of individuals has any chance of manipulating the market for an extended period of time, right? You're going to have Goldman Sachs people with their algorithms looking for these deviations, being like, wait, what? There's a whole bunch of buying's going on. We got to get in there before the competitor firm does and buy the price back down.
Which then opens up the opportunity, I suppose, for hedge funds to have I guess they already have an undue influence in society to a certain extent, but then it's an interesting path to go down where reality starts being more reflective of a profit or loss incentive, which maybe it already is like that to a certain extent.
It is, but I think that's the beauty of it. People care about money. And well, they care about money a lot, especially at Goldman Sachs. And what they're trying to do is maximize profit. And to maximize profit, you have to calibrate your prediction as accurately as you can. And if you're wrong, you lose a lot of money. And if you're right, you can win a lot of money.
So the solution to all these problems is to just turn every person on the planet into gamblers, basically.
Gamify everything. Yeah.
Well, I mean, most people wouldn't do it. I'm not going to do it in a well-functioning prediction market. I'm not going to play unless it happens to be a question that I have deep expertise in, right, and I think I can outperform. But on most questions, I'm not going to throw my money in there. If I do, yeah, it would just be for fun, kind of like I do on sports betting. Like, I don't think I can beat that house. I'm not that good, right? I'm just throwing money away to make the game a little more fun to watch. And maybe I would throw some money in a presidential election just because it would be more fun to follow the presidential election. But I'm not going to expect to win any money. And I, for the most part, I'm just not going to partake. It's going to be the big money players battling each other to see the person that gets closest to the truth wins.
It's going to, I think, raise the rates of hitmen globally where...
Yeah, you think that, but whenever you start thinking about those kind of like problems of like, well, I bet all, you just look to the stock market. We don't see those kind of problems all the time in the stock market, but the same opportunities exist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we're talking about politics, you know, like quite literally like putting, I guess the Dole Fruit Company was like staging coups in Central America to provide more favorable circumstances. Like, this wouldn't really bring anything new to it, but, you know, if Goldman Sachs has got significant resources invested in a particular political outcome in some country in the Southern Hemisphere, you know, why wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, you know, you might want some regulations around certain types of questions. And you might want some monitoring of who's investing, and what questions, to see if somebody else did buy a big position in this outcome. And then 2 days later, this person was murdered. Right. I mean, those things are still against the law. And I would say we do see a lot of opportunity, similar opportunities in the stock market, but at least we don't see very many people doing it.
Is there any opportunity to kind of refine policy making attached to prediction markets? Is there a way to?
Yeah. Yeah. So this really comes from, Robin Hanson, who's you might know him. He wrote a book called Elephant in the Brain. He's a blogger. He wrote a short paper, arguing for what's called futarchy. And the basic idea is democracy is bad because the people voting they know what they want. They have values about how they want the world to look. And that's fine. That's a great part of democracy. What we're going after needs to sort of be collectively decided, but how to get it, the public they have no idea. And they start to get involved in those debates, and it just gets awful and dumbed down. And so the sort of his utopian vision is that, well, when it comes to how we get something, we give it over to what's called a conditional prediction market. So you say, I'll keep a simple example. We're going to roll out a new education program. I don't know. Nationwide, the Department of Education has this new thing they want to do. And the goal is to increase math and reading scores by X. But there's this competitor, program by the Republicans. They want to do vouchers or something, some other approach to maximize, to getting these test scores up. Well, you could set up two prediction markets, and the prediction market basically says, if we pass plan A, test scores will be above blank. And then the second one is, if we do plan B, test scores will be above blank 5 years from now, whatever the timeline is that people care about. All right. Now people can bet in those two markets, and whichever one has the highest probability of achieving the goals, that one gets selected as policy. The one that didn't get selected, that betting market gets canceled. Everybody just gets their money back. But the one that got selected is now a full-on prediction market. And if you bet that on this one that the test scores will go up, and they don't, you lose all your money, right? And that is his maybe too simple explanation. I haven't read that paper in a long time, but that's what I remember taking away from it. That we could start putting some important policy decisions to prediction markets.
Could you see like political parties like that are advocating for certain positions be like the main like players in that market? Like, yeah, put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it would have been fun for, right, Biden to have set up a prediction market for the VP nominee, like who should be the VP, who has the best chance of winning if I don't run again. I think that, right, they would have ended up making a much better choice than they did.
No arguing that one. Yeah. No, there's definitely a lot of interesting possibilities with prediction markets, and maybe it deserves a, you know, its own kind of episode and deep dive, because it's very interesting. I'm still like, I would be interested to know what its impacts are, because I think there's, even if no one's manipulating the market, I still think there's some interesting feedback loops with people seeing like what everyone else is thinking and like reacting to it. I mean, it's not any different than, I guess, how it would be maybe in a small tribe, but
I just wonder.
Yeah, I'm still curious.
My knee jerk is just like, instead of investing into public education, improving civics education, improving literacy rates and the quality of public school programs, like motherfuckers would literally just jump to like, oh, we should just like attach a prediction market to this entire thing. Like
it's, but if it helps find better ways to improve those things, and because right now our mechanisms, well, I mean, there's so many things broken in our system that it's hard to even.
I think the problem isn't yeah. like, we know what the remedies are. We have gridlock in decision making, and we have captured institutions that make it far more difficult to implement some of these policies. Where, you know, I think in this model where decision markets deployed to guide policy at kind of this national level, let's say this example of like the Department of Education program, I mean, would vested interests even allow something like that to be passed to begin with? Because that's ultimately speaking the problem we've run up against with a lot of things. So like, I don't know, the defense budget being one of those things, yeah. Where, you know, there is a lot of parties with invested interest to keep the defense budget inflated and, you know, constantly getting more and more amendments passed to it to increase funding for these sorts of things, because that benefits stakeholders that have their finger on the scales to a certain extent.
I think if prediction markets become a bigger part of our policymaking and things of that sort, that is first going to require prediction markets to just become more successful on the sort of basic educational questions where we're having debates and nobody knows which expert to trust, and people start referring to prediction markets. I hope and think that can become a part of the culture. Right. Why do I think that? Because I've seen conversations just get so much more sophisticated over time. Like I read ESPN, have forever, and the conversations that are had on ESPN articles now are just infinitely more sophisticated than they were 20 years ago when I was reading them. Mm. Like they just talk smarter, that more nuanced use of statistics. Like, and I think that we could get people interested in referring to these, and once the world understands and is thinking in these terms, then I don't know what the possibilities are, right? Maybe that does start to open up possibilities for using it for policymaking. You know, there are lots of other sort of exciting ways to use them that people have come up with. But the good news is right now there have been a string some victories for the U.S.-based prediction markets against the regulators. Kalshi, which is our big U.S.-based one now, has been in a legal fight with the CFTC. They regulate commodities trading, so these prediction markets fall under their jurisdiction for some reason. And they've been trying to ban Kalshi from having a presidential election market, but have so far been unsuccessful in the courts.
Has the 2018 Supreme Court case influenced prediction markets? Like the one that allowed, I guess it was collegiate sports betting or something like that. Is that like paving the way for prediction markets?
Not that I've seen, but I haven't followed the litigation all that closely. I had a student look into it and write it up, but I was reading at the time, so I didn't read it very deeply.
I mean, my completely uneducated observation on this is that specific to, I mean, this is the first presidential election cycle where you had kind of like the publicly accessible betting pools for the candidates. That to me almost, it felt like it went hand in hand to this phenomenon over the past 2 years of like more and more advertisements for like sports betting platforms, where it's kind of becoming far more accepted that.
Yeah, maybe they're riding a cultural wave of sorts. But I think in the nitty gritty, like legal battle, I don't think that case showed up or helped.
Well, but, to be continued. I think there's a lot more here that we could discuss, but I think this is a really great conversation, Ryan. Thanks. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Ryan, is there a way for listeners to access your work anywhere? I guess beyond like pirating things off of academia website.
Just Google my name on Google Scholar. Stuff.